was the only American at the site. Two keys were required to launch the missiles. One was held by the American, the other by an Italian officer. The keys were often worn on a string around the neck, like a dog tag. Congressman Chet Holyfield, the chairman of the Joint Committee, was amazed to find three ballistic missiles carrying thermonuclear weapons in the custody of a single American officer with a handgun. All the Italians have to do is hit him on the head with a blackjack, and they have got his key, Holyfield said during a closed-door committee hearing after the trip. The Jupiters were located near a forest, without any protective covering, and brightly illuminated at night. They would be sitting ducks for a sniper. There were three Jupiters sitting there in the open, all pointed toward the sky, Holyfield told the committee. Over $300 million has been spent to set up that little show, and it can be knocked out with three rifle bullets. Foreign personnel weren't supposed to enter the nuclear weapon igloos at NATO bases, but little had been done to stop them. A lone American soldier manned the entrance to the igloos, serving as a custodian of the weapons, not as an armed guard. Once again, security was provided by troops from the host nation, who also moved weapons in and out of the storage facilities. Senator Albert A. Gore Sr. could hardly believe the arrangement. Non-Americans with non-American vehicles are transporting nuclear weapons from place to place in foreign countries. It was one thing to entrust these weapons to the Strategic Air Command, with its strict operating procedures and rigorous devotion to checklists. But the competence of NATO troops varied considerably, and their level of professionalism wasn't the most important consideration when it came to guarding America's nuclear weapons. The prime loyalty of the guards, of course, is to their own nation and not to the U.S., the Joint Committee said. A nuclear weapon might be stolen by a deranged or psychotic NATO soldier, by a group of officers seeking political power, or by the government of a host nation for use against an enemy other than the Soviet Union. These scenarios were unfortunately plausible. A pair of NATO countries, Greece and Turkey, despised each other and would soon go to war over the island of Cyprus. Right-wing officers had staged two coups d'état in Turkey during the previous year, and Jupiter missiles were scheduled for deployment there in the fall of 1961. Covertly funded by the Soviet Union, the Italian Communist Party had strong support in the region where Jupiter missiles were based. Members of the party might seek to sabotage or steal a nuclear weapon. Concerns about theft weren't absurd or far-fetched. A few months after the Joint Committee's visit to NATO bases, a group of dissident French officers sought to gain control of a nuclear device in Algeria as part of a coup. At the time, Algeria was the site of French nuclear tests and a French colony fighting for independence. A nuclear test, codenamed Gerboise Verte, was promptly conducted in the Sahara Desert so that the officers attempting to overthrow President Charles de Gaulle couldn't get hold of a nuclear device. "Refrain from detonating your little bomb," General Maurice Schall, one of the coup leaders, had urged the head of the Special Weapons Command. "Keep it for us. It will always be useful." In addition to being loosely controlled by the United States, the nuclear weapons in the NATO stockpile were often old and poorly maintained. According to the Joint Committee's report, NATO had been turned into the dumping ground for obsolete warheads and weapons systems that were nevertheless placed in an alert position of 15 minutes readiness without adequate safety precautions. Congressman Holyfield estimated that about half of the Jupiters wouldn't take off if the order to launch was ever given. The missiles were complicated, liquid-fueled, and leaky. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff admitted that, from a military standpoint, the Jupiters were useful mainly for increasing the number of targets that the Soviet Union would have to hit during a first strike. "It would have been better to dump them in the ocean," Eisenhower later said of the missiles, "instead of trying to dump them on our allies." The Mark VII atomic bombs carried by NATO fighters had been rushed into production during the Korean War, almost a decade earlier. The nickel-cadmium batteries of a Mark VII constantly had to be recharged, and its nuclear core had to be carefully placed into an in-flight insertion mechanism before takeoff. The bombs were not designed for use during an alert. Once the core was inserted, a Mark VII wasn't one point safe, and the bomb had to undergo at least 20 different diagnostic tests, increasing the odds of a mistake during assembly and disassembly. It was plagued by mechanical problems and seemed to invite human error. Harold Agnew was amazed to see a group of NATO weapon handlers pull the arming wires out of a Mark VII while unloading it from a plane. When the wires were pulled, the arming sequence began, and if the X unit charged, a Mark VII could be detonated by its radar, by its barometric switches, by its timer, or by falling just a few feet from a plane and landing on a runway. A stray cosmic ray could theoretically detonate it. The weapon seemed to invite mistakes. A rocket-propelled version of the Mark VII was unloaded, fully armed, with its X unit charged, from a U.S. Navy plane in the spring of 1960. The ground crew had inadvertently yanked out the arming wires. An incident report noted defects in another Mark VII. During initial inspection after receipt of a War Reserve Mark VII Mod 5 bomb, it was observed that the safing and arming wires were in reversed locations in the arm safe retainer assembly, i.e., the arming wires were in the safing wire location and the safing wires were in the arming wire location. Four screws were missing from the assembly. And a Mark VII sometimes contained things it shouldn't. A screwdriver was found inside one of the bombs, an Allen wrench was somehow left inside another. In both bombs, the loose tools could have caused a short circuit. The risk of a nuclear accident at a European base was increased by the fact that the training and operating manuals for the Mark VII, indeed for all the weapons in the NATO atomic stockpile, were written in English. But many of the NATO personnel who handled the weapons could not read or speak English, and few of them knew what to do if something went wrong. In many areas we visited, the Joint Committee found, little or no explosive ordnance disposal, EOD, capability was available in the event of accidental radioactive contamination resulting from fire, carelessness, or accident, or in the event of threat to custody and security of the weapon requiring emergency disposal. Western Europe was more densely populated than the United States, and a cloud of plutonium released by a nuclear weapon could threaten a large number of people. The possibility of such an accident was far from remote, according to the Joint Committee. It cited a mishap on January 16, 1961, just a few days before Kennedy's inauguration. The underwing fuel tanks of a U.S. Air Force F-100D fighter were mistakenly jettisoned when the pilot started the engines. The plane was on alert at the Lakenheath Air Base in Suffolk, England. The fuel tanks hit the runway and ruptured. Some fuel ignited, and a Mark 28 hydrogen bomb mounted beneath the plane was engulfed in flames. Firefighters managed to extinguish the blaze before the weapon's high explosives could detonate or ignite. Because the accident occurred at a military base, away from the scrutiny of the press and the public, neither the American government nor the British would acknowledge that it happened. The Joint Committee on Atomic Energy unanimously agreed that the Jupiter missiles should be removed from Italy and should never be deployed in Turkey. The missiles seemed to pose more of a threat to NATO one way or another than to the Soviets, and placing missiles with thermonuclear warheads in Turkey, a politically unstable country that bordered the Soviet Union, might be viewed as a provocation at the Kremlin. The Joint Committee also recommended that the Mark VII bomb either be removed from the NATO stockpile or fitted with a trajectory sensing switch so that a mistake by a ground crew would be less likely to cause an accidental detonation. Moreover, The current fictional custody arrangements had to be replaced with measures that gave the United States real possession and control of its nuclear weapons in Europe. A lone American sentry, ordered to stand on a runway for 8 hours at a time, was bound to start goofing off. The committee wanted at least two American soldiers keeping an eye on the igloos, the missiles, the fighter planes on alert. It wanted American vehicles and troops at every major NATO base capable of evacuating or destroying nuclear weapons that an enemy or an ally might want to seize. And most of all, the committee wanted some kind of mechanical device added to NATO's weapons so that unauthorized personnel couldn't detonate them. Harold Agnew had recently met with Donald R. Cotter, a supervisor at Sandia, about the best way to install use controls on a nuclear weapon. Cotter mentioned an electromechanical lock that Sandia was developing for atomic landmines. The weapons were essentially time bombs that NATO troops could arm and then leave behind to destroy buildings, bridges, airfields, or units of an invading Red Army. The new lock had originally been conceived as a safety device. Because these weapons wouldn't be dropped from a plane or launched by a missile, a trajectory sensing switch wouldn't help to prevent accidental detonations. The G-forces that a landmine would normally experience before being armed would be the same as those of the soldier carrying it, and the weapon might sit for hours or days before exploding. But a motor-driven lock inside the mine, connected by a long cable to a handheld decoder, would allow troops to arm the weapon from a safe distance. Agnew thought that sort of lock would solve many of the custody problems at NATO. A coded switch installed in every nuclear weapon would block the crucial arming circuits. It would make a clear distinction between the physical possession of a weapon and the ability to use one. It would become a form of remote control, and the power to exert that control, to prohibit or allow a nuclear detonation, would remain with whoever had the code. Agnew brought an early version of the electromechanical locking system to Washington, D.C. for a closed-door hearing of the Joint Committee, putting the switch and the decoder in the seat next to him on a commercial flight from Albuquerque. The coded switch that went inside a weapon weighed about a pound. The decoder weighed about 40. It was a black box with knobs, numbers, and a series of colored lights on it, powered by a large internal battery. To unlock a nuclear weapon, a two-man custodial team would attach a cable to it from the decoder. Then they'd turn the knobs on the decoder to enter a four-digit code. It was a split knowledge code. Each custodian would be given only two of the four numbers. Once the correct code was entered, the switch inside the weapon would take anywhere from 30 seconds to 2.5 minutes to unlock, as its little gears, cams, and cam followers whirred and spun. When Agnew and Cotter showed the committee how the new lock worked, it didn't. Something was wrong. But none of the senators, congressmen, or committee staff members realized that it wouldn't unlock, no matter how many times the proper code was entered. The decoder looked impressive, the colored lights flashed, and everyone in the hearing room agreed that it was absolutely essential for national security. The American military, however, vehemently opposed putting any locks on nuclear weapons. The Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Power at SAC, General Norstad at NATO, all of them agreed that locks were a bad idea. The always-never dilemma lay at the heart of military's thinking. No single device can be expected to increase both safety and readiness, the Joint Chiefs of Staff argued, and readiness was considered more important. The nuclear weapons in Europe were adequately safe, within the limits of the operational requirements imposed on them. Although the description adequately safe was hardly reassuring, the possibility of America's nuclear weapons being rendered useless during wartime when their locks somehow malfunctioned was more worrisome to the Joint Chiefs. Even if the locking and unlocking mechanisms worked flawlessly, use of the weapons would depend on effective code management. If only a few people were allowed to know the code, then the death of those few or an inability to reach them in an emergency could prevent the weapons from being unlocked. But if the code was too widely shared, the locks would offer little protection against unauthorized use. The Joint Committee's desire for stronger use controls threatened to add complexity and uncertainty to the command and control of nuclear weapons. A State Department official summarized the military's position: "All is well with the atomic stockpile program, and there is no need for any changes." The Kennedy administration was far more receptive to the committee's proposals. The former RAND analysts at the Pentagon were familiar with Fred Eakley's work and his recommendation 2 years earlier that locks should be put on nuclear weapons. Jerome Wiesner, the president's science advisor, met with Agnew and agreed that something had to be done about NATO's atomic stockpile. Wiesner was deeply concerned about the risk of an unauthorized or accidental detonation. He had trained as an electrical engineer, briefly worked at Los Alamos, and advised Eisenhower on nuclear issues. Wiesner supported placing locks on the weapons, but had no illusions that locks would completely solve the problem. A skilled technician could open a stolen nuclear weapon and unlock it within a few hours. But Wiesner thought that the locks might help to buy time after a weapon had been taken, stop individual psychotics, and prevent unauthorized use by military forces holding the weapons during periods of high tension or military combat. For Secretary of Defense McNamara, the locks were part of a larger effort to regain not only American control, but also civilian control of nuclear weapons. He felt adamant that the President of the United States should have the sole authority to order a weapon's use. The military had gained far too much power over the nuclear arsenal since the days of Harry Truman, McNamara thought, and the lack of civilian oversight at NATO was chilling. The Davy Crockett recoilless rifle was especially problematic. Its atomic projectiles weighed about 50 pounds and would be easy to steal. They were small enough to fit in a duffel bag or a backpack. After reading the Joint Committee's report, President Kennedy halted the dispersal of nuclear weapons among America's NATO allies. Studies on weapon safety and command and control were commissioned. At Sandia, the development of coded electromechanical locks was begun on a crash basis. Known at first as prescribed action links, the locks were given a new name, one that sounded less restrictive, in the hopes of appeasing the military. Permissive action links sounded more friendly, as did the acronym PALS. Within 7 weeks of President Kennedy's inauguration, the broad outlines of his defense policies were set. Spending on conventional forces would increase, more Polaris submarines would be built, and intercontinental ballistic missiles would largely replace bombers. Missiles were thought to be faster, cheaper, and less likely to be destroyed in a surprise attack. The Atlases, Titans, Jupiters, and Thors, so recently rushed into service, would be decommissioned as soon as possible. Less expensive, solid-fueled missiles would replace them. McNamara and his team had come to believe that nuclear weapons with a lower yield were more cost-effective. The Minuteman missile carried a 1 megaton warhead, and calculations suggested that 5 of them would inflict more damage than a single 9 megaton warhead carried by a Titan II. Nevertheless, a relatively small number of Titan II missiles would be retained for the time being. They would be useful for destroying naval bases, missile complexes, and underground command centers. The Polaris submarine seemed like the ideal weapon system for the Kennedy administration's strategic goals. The 16 missiles on each sub would serve as a powerful deterrent to the Soviets, greatly increasing the odds that the United States could offer some sort of nuclear response after a surprise attack. Safely hidden beneath the ocean, the submarines could also give the president more time to think or negotiate during a crisis. In 1958, the Navy had requested a dozen Polaris subs. Facing intense pressure from Congress, Eisenhower later agreed to deploy 19. Kennedy decided to build 41. The 656 missiles of the Polaris fleet would be aimed solely at counter-value targets, at civilians who lived in the major cities of the Soviet Union. The Air Force didn't like most of the Pentagon's new spending priorities, which seemed to favor the Army and the Navy. The B-47 bomber, long the mainstay of the Strategic Air Command and the favorite ride of Colonel Jimmy Stewart, was to be taken out of service. No additional B-52 bombers would be built. The fate of a supersonic replacement for the B-52 was suddenly uncertain, and plans for a nuclear-powered bomber were scrapped. McNamara had concluded that bombers were not only too costly to operate, but increasingly vulnerable to Soviet air defenses. The B-47 and the B-52 had been designed for high-altitude bombing. They would now have to attack at low altitudes to avoid Soviet radar. And the Soviets were beginning to put atomic warheads on their anti-aircraft missiles as well. During an attack on the Soviet Union, about half of SAC's bomber crews, if not more, were expected to lose their lives. General Curtis LeMay, the second in command at the Air Force, had little use for McNamara and his whiz kids. Few of them had served in the armed forces, let alone seen combat, yet they acted like military experts. They seemed arrogant and clueless. General Thomas D. White, the Air Force Chief of Staff, had similar misgivings, later criticizing the pipe-smoking, tree-full-of-owls type of so-called professional defense intellectuals who have been brought into this nation's capital. LeMay was convinced that long-range bombers were still the best weapons for strategic warfare. The Pentagon had never allowed SAC to test-launch a ballistic missile with a live nuclear warhead, despite many requests. Such a launch, with a flight path over the United States, was considered too risky. Dummy warheads were successfully tested instead on missiles fired from Vandenberg, and the same fusing and firing mechanisms would presumably detonate a real one. But LeMay didn't want the survival of the United States to depend on a weapon that had never been fully tested, and the idea of a limited war still seemed ridiculous to him. The phrase was an oxymoron. If you won't fight to win, LeMay argued, then you damn well shouldn't fight. His protege at SAC, General Power, felt the same way and continued to push for a counterforce strategy, aiming at military targets. For that task, Polaris missiles, relatively inaccurate and impossible to launch simultaneously as one massive salvo, were useless. To placate the Air Force and gain additional security against a surprise attack, McNamara raised the proportion of SAC bombers on ground alert from 1/3 to 1/2. The number of bombers on airborne alert was increased as well. 12 B-52s were soon in the air at all times, loaded with thermonuclear weapons as part of Operation Chrome Dome. Every day, 6 of the bombers would head north and circumnavigate the perimeter of Canada. 4 would cross the Atlantic and circle the Mediterranean, and 2 would fly to the ballistic missile early warning facility in Thule, Greenland, and orbit it for hours, maintaining visual or radio contact with the base, just to make sure that it was still there. Thule would probably be hit by Soviet missiles during the initial stage of a surprise attack. Known as the Thule Monitor, the B-52 assured SAC, more reliably than any bomb alarm system, that the United States was not yet at war. Feuds between the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force continued, despite McNamara's vow that the Pentagon would have one defense policy, not 3 conflicting defense policies. Inter-service rivalries once again complicated the effort to develop a rational nuclear strategy. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had been instructed to alter the PSYOP so that President Kennedy would have a number of options during a nuclear war. Studies were underway to make that possible. But the nuclear ambitions of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force still seemed incompatible, and at times, incomprehensible. General Maxwell Taylor had contended in his best-selling book that the Army needed more money to fight conventional wars, an argument that helped to make him the principal military advisor to President Kennedy. Nevertheless, with Taylor's support, the Army was now seeking 32,000 nuclear weapons for use on the battlefield. Even the little Davy Crockett was portrayed as an indispensable weapon, despite the risk of theft. The handheld atomic rifles were as urgently needed, the Army claimed, as intercontinental ballistic missiles. McNamara still couldn't understand the rationale for battlefield nuclear weapons and challenged the Army to answer a series of questions about them. Is the purpose of our tactical weapons to prevent the Soviets from using their tactical weapons? Can the Army defend Europe with them without destroying Europe? And how will our own troops survive the fallout? The maximum range of the Davy Crockett was so short, about a mile and a half, that the soldiers who fired it stood a good chance of being killed by it. In response to McNamara's questions, the Army admitted that its request for 32,000 nuclear weapons might appear to be unreasonably high. But General Taylor insisted that tactical weapons would serve as a valuable first step on the ladder of nuclear escalation. They would demonstrate American resolve, and the United States obviously needed to have them, if the enemy does. The latest intelligence reports on the Soviet Union added a new twist to the debate over America's nuclear strategy. Within weeks of taking office, President Kennedy found out that the missile gap did not exist. Like the bomber gap, it was a myth. For years, it had been sustained by faulty assumptions, Soviet deception, and a willingness at the Department of Defense to believe the worst-case scenario, especially when it justified more spending on defense. The CIA had estimated that the Soviet Union might have 500 long-range ballistic missiles by the middle of 1961. Air Force intelligence had warned that the Soviets might soon have twice that number. But aerial photographs of the Soviet Union, taken by U-2 spy planes and the new Discoverer spy satellite, now suggested that those estimates were wrong. The photos confirmed the existence of only 4 missiles that could reach the United States. Instead of deploying long-range missiles to attack the United States, the Soviets had built hundreds of medium and intermediate-range missiles to destroy the major cities of Western Europe. The strategy had been dictated in large part by necessity. Khrushchev's boasts that his factories were turning out 250 long-range missiles a year, that the Soviet Union had more missiles than it would ever need, were all a bluff. For years, the Soviet missile program had been plagued with engineering and design problems. Medium-range missiles were less technologically demanding. It wasn't easy to build a weapon that could fly 6,000 miles and put a warhead near its target. And on October 24, 1960, the Soviet program had secretly endured a major setback. Like the Atlas, the first Soviet long-range missiles used liquid oxygen as a propellant, and they required a lengthy fueling process before launch. A new Soviet missile, the R-16, used hypergolic propellants stored separately within its airframe, like the Titan II. The R-16 would be able to lift off within minutes. It was the largest missile that had ever been built, and Khrushchev was eager for its inaugural flight to take place before November 7th, the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Marshal Mitrofan Ivanovich Nedelin, head of the Soviet Strategic Rocket Forces, traveled to Kazakhstan and supervised preparations for the launch of an R-16 at the Baikonur Cosmodrome. As the giant missile sat on the launch pad, full of oxidizer and fuel, a series of malfunctions occurred. Angry about the delay, under tremendous pressure from the Kremlin, and eager to know what was wrong, Nedelin drove to the pad. Half an hour before the scheduled launch, a crew of technicians was working on the missile when its second stage engine started without warning. Flames from the engine shot downward and ignited the fuel tank of the first stage. Marshal Nedelin was sitting in a chair about 50 feet from the missile when it exploded. He was killed, along with many of the Soviet Union's top rocket scientists and about 100 other people. The chief designer of the R-16, Mikhail Yangel, happened to be taking a cigarette break in an underground bunker and survived the explosion. Movie cameras set up to record the launch instead captured some horrific images. Men running for their lives as an immense fireball pursues and then engulfs them. Men falling to the ground, their clothes on fire. Everywhere clouds of deadly smoke with a reddish glow. The following day, TASS, the official Soviet news agency, announced that Nedelin had been killed in a plane crash. Far from being grounds for celebration, the absence of a missile gap became a potential source of embarrassment for the Kennedy administration. Many of the claims made by the Democrats during the recent presidential campaign now seemed baseless. Although General Power still insisted that the Soviets were hiding their long-range missiles beneath camouflage, the United States clearly had not fallen behind in the nuclear arms race. Public knowledge of that fact would be inconvenient, and so the public wasn't told. When McNamara admitted that the missile gap was a myth during an off-the-record briefing with reporters, President Kennedy was displeased. At a press conference the following day, Kennedy stressed that it would be premature to reach a judgment as to whether there is a gap or not a gap. Soon the whole issue was forgotten. Political concerns, not strategic ones, determined how many long-range, land-based missiles the United States would build. Before Sputnik, President Eisenhower had thought that 20 to 40 would be enough. Jerome Wiesner advised President Kennedy that roughly 10 times that number would be sufficient for deterrence. But General Power wanted the Strategic Air Command to have 10,000 Minuteman missiles aimed at every military target in the Soviet Union that might threaten the United States. And members of Congress, unaware that the missile gap was a myth, also sought a large land-based force. After much back and forth, McNamara decided to build 1,000 Minuteman missiles. One Pentagon advisor later explained that it was a round number. While disagreements over nuclear strategy continued at the White House and the Pentagon, the need for an improved command and control system was beyond dispute. For McNamara, it was the most urgent national security issue that the United States faced, a matter of transcendent priority. A few weeks after his briefing on WSAG-R-50 and the threat of a surprise attack, McNamara outlined the problem to Kennedy. "The chain of command from the president down to our strategic offensive and defensive weapon systems is highly vulnerable in almost every link. The destruction of about a dozen sites, most of which are soft, none of which is adequately hardened, would deprive U.S. forces of all high-level command and control. Without the survival of at least some of these sites, including the one containing the president, his successor, or designated replacement, with their communications, there can be no authorized response in the event of a nuclear attack on the U.S. The Soviet Union might not need 1,000 missiles to prevail in a nuclear war. 20 or 30 might do. And the relative weakness of the Soviets, the small size of their missile arsenal, had oddly become a source of anxiety. It might encourage the Soviet Union to strike first. A decapitation attack, launched without warning like a bolt out of the blue, might be the Kremlin's only hope of achieving victory. A centralized, effective command and control system would ensure that the United States could retaliate, and that the order to do so would be given by the president. The demands placed on such a system would be enormous if the Soviets attacked. The system would have to classify the attack as large or small, a Pentagon report later noted, accidental or deliberate, selective or indiscriminate, against cities or not, against high command or not, in order to support a decision as to an appropriate retaliatory response. The system had to do those things in real time, and it had to maintain communications between the president, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and military commanders throughout a nuclear war. After commissioning a number of studies on command and control, McNamara approved the creation of a new entity, the Worldwide Military Command and Control System, WWMCCS. It would combine the radars, sensors, computers, and communications networks of the different armed services into a single integrated system. The challenges were formidable. Making the system work would require not only technological and administrative changes, but also new ways of thinking about command. The task was further complicated by the efforts of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force to retain as much authority as possible over their own facilities and resist any centralized system run by civilians. Although the bureaucratic struggle between the demands of centralization and decentralization proved difficult to resolve at the Pentagon, Paul Baran, a researcher at RAND, came up with an ingenious method of harmonizing the two within a digital communications network. Centralized and even decentralized networks, like those traditionally used to broadcast radio or television, to send messages by telegraph or telephone, could be shut down by the destruction of a few crucial nodes. Any hierarchical network would remain vulnerable at its apex, at the point where all the lines of communication converged. The first duty of the command and control system is to survive, Baran argued, proposing a distributed network with hundreds or thousands of separate nodes connected through multiple paths. Messages would be broken into smaller blocks, sent along the first available path, and reassembled at their final destination. If nodes were out of service or destroyed, the network would automatically adapt and send the data along a route that was still intact. Baran's work later provided the conceptual basis for the top secret communications networks at the Pentagon, as well as their civilian offshoot, the Internet. The survival of America's military and civilian leadership would be harder to achieve. As a subset of the worldwide military command and control system, a new administrative structure was established. The National Military Command Center replaced the Joint War Room at the Pentagon. It would serve as the nation's military headquarters during a nuclear war. Since the Pentagon was likely to be destroyed at the beginning of that war, an alternate National Military Command Center was formed at Site R, inside Raven Rock Mountain. It would have the data processing and communications equipment necessary to manage the PSYOP. It would be staffed year-round, 24 hours a day, awaiting the arrival of the President and the Joint Chiefs during an emergency. But fixed sites now seemed like easy targets for Soviet missiles. McNamara thought that the United States also needed mobile command centers that would be difficult to find and destroy. The Air Force wanted these command centers to be located on airplanes. SAC already had a plane, nicknamed Looking Glass, in the air at all times as a backup to its headquarters in Omaha. The Navy wanted the command centers to be located on ships. McNamara decided to do both, creating the National Emergency Airborne Command Post and the National Emergency Command Post afloat. None of these command posts would matter if there were no means of transmitting the go code after a nuclear attack on the United States. The Navy began work on an airborne system for contacting its Polaris submarines. Take charge and move out. TACAMO planes would quickly get off the ground, climb steeply, and send an emergency war order on a very low-frequency radio using an antenna 5 miles long. SAC began to develop a post-attack command and control system. It would rely on airborne command posts, a command post on a train, a command post at the bottom of an abandoned gold mine in Cripple Creek, Colorado, and a command post known as the Notch inside Bear Mountain near Amherst, Massachusetts. The bunker in Cripple Creek was never constructed. Airborne facilities were less expensive and more likely to survive than those underground. The emergency rocket communication system provided another layer of redundancy. If SAC's airborne command posts somehow failed to send the go code, it could be sent by radio transmitters installed in a handful of Minuteman missiles. A pre-recorded voice message up to 90 seconds long would be broadcast to bomber crews and launch crews as the specially equipped missiles flew over SAC bases. The most intractable problem was finding a way to keep the president alive. The National Emergency Airborne Command Post was placed on full-time alert at Andrews Air Force Base near Washington, D.C. But the plane would need at least 10 or 15 minutes to take off, and it would need another 10 minutes to fly beyond the lethal range of a thermonuclear explosion. At least half an hour of warning might be necessary for the president to reach Andrews, get into the airborne command post, and escape the blast. Traveling by helicopter to the National Emergency Command Post afloat, a Navy cruiser kept off the coast would take even longer, and a Soviet missile attack might come with little or no warning. After considering a variety of options, Secretary of Defense McNamara and Secretary of State Dean Rusk supported the construction of the National Deep Underground Command Center. McNamara described the bunker as a logical, survivable node in the control structure, a unified strategic command and control center under duly constituted political authorities. It would be located beneath the Pentagon at a depth of 3,500 feet. High-speed elevators, a light rail system, and horizontal tunnels more than half a mile underground would link it to the White House. It would hold anywhere from 50 to 300 people, depending on whether Kennedy chose to build an austere version or one of moderate size. It was designed to withstand multiple direct hits of 200 to 300 MT, megaton weapons bursting at the surface, or 100 MT weapons penetrating to depths of 70 to 100 feet. If the Soviets attacked on that scale and the new bunker met those design goals, the president and his staff could expect to be the only people still alive in Washington, D.C. Amid all the consideration of how to protect the president and the Joint Chiefs, how to gather information in real time, how to transmit war orders, how to devise the technical and administrative means for a flexible response, little thought had been given to an important question. How do you end a nuclear war? Thomas Schelling, a professor of economics at Harvard, a RAND analyst, proponent of game theory, and advisor to the Kennedy administration, began to worry about the issue early in 1961. While heading a committee on the risk of war by accident, miscalculation, or surprise, he was amazed to learn that there was no direct, secure form of communications between the White House and the Kremlin. It seemed almost unbelievable. Schelling had read the novel Red Alert a few years earlier, bought 40 copies, and sent them to colleagues. The book gave a good sense of what could go wrong, and yet the president's ability to call his Soviet counterpart on a hotline existed only in fiction. As things stood, AT&T's telephone lines and Western Union's telegraph lines were the only direct links between the United States and the Soviet Union. Both of them would be knocked out by a thermonuclear blast, and most radio communications would be as well. The command and control systems of the two countries had no formal, reliable means of interacting. The problem was so serious and so obvious, Schelling thought, everybody must have assumed somebody else had taken care of it. Pauses for negotiation would be a waste of time if there were no way to negotiate. And once a nuclear war began, no matter how pointless, devastating, and horrific, it might not end until both sides ran out of nuclear weapons. The Brink. Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind, President John F. Kennedy told a gathering of world leaders at the United Nations on September 25, 1961. Dag Hammarskjöld, the beloved Secretary General of the United Nations, had recently died in a plane crash, and to honor his memory, Kennedy gave a speech that called for world peace and stressed the UN's central role as a peacekeeper. He also revived the hope that nuclear weapons could be outlawed through an international agreement. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. The events and decisions of the next 10 months may well decide the fate of man for the next 10,000 years. There will be no avoiding those events. There will be no appeal from those decisions. And we in this hall shall be remembered either as part of the generation that turned this planet into a flaming funeral pyre, or the generation that met its vow to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war. Instead of an arms race, Kennedy challenged the Soviets to join the United States in a peace race, a series of steps that would lead to general and complete disarmament under the supervision of the UN. He proposed a ban on nuclear testing, an end to the production of fissile material for use in nuclear weapons, a prohibition on the transfer of nuclear weapons to other countries, and the destruction of all nuclear weapons, as well as their delivery systems. Kennedy had no illusions about the perfectibility of mankind, only a desire for its survival. Such a plan would not bring a world free from conflict or greed, but it would bring a world free from the terrors of mass destruction. It would not usher in the era of the superstate, but it would usher in an era in which no state could annihilate or be annihilated by another. The abolition of nuclear weapons couldn't be postponed any longer. "Together we shall save our planet," he said, "or together we shall perish in its flames." During the same week that Kennedy appealed for an end to the arms race at the United Nations, he met with a handful of military advisors at the White House to discuss launching a surprise attack on the Soviet Union. General Thomas Power encouraged him to do it. According to notes of the meeting held on September 20th, Power warned that the United States now faced the greatest danger ever of a Soviet nuclear attack. "If a general atomic war is inevitable," he argued, "the U.S. should strike first." Power was not the only high-ranking officer having such thoughts. Kennedy had just received a memo from General Maxwell Taylor summarizing how an American first strike might proceed. Taylor didn't recommend it or rule it out. "There are risks as well as opportunities in this approach," he wrote. The United States and the Soviet Union were, at the time, engaged in their most serious confrontation since the Berlin airlift of 1948. And once again, Berlin was at the center of the crisis. 16 years after the defeat of the Nazis, the city was still divided among 4 occupying powers: the British, French, and Americans in the West, the Soviets in the East. The division was economic as well as political. While communist East Berlin stagnated, capitalist West Berlin thrived. But it was a fragile prosperity. Located deep within East Germany, linked to West Germany only by air and a 110-mile stretch of highway, the free sectors of Berlin were surrounded by troops from the Soviet bloc. NATO forces in the city were vastly outnumbered. America's nuclear weapons were all that protected West Berlin from being overrun. Since 1958, the Soviet Union had been threatening to sign a treaty with East Germany, hand over the eastern part of the city to its communist ally, and block NATO access to West Berlin. The threat was forcefully repeated at a summit meeting between President Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev in June 1961. The Soviet Union seemed ascendant, having recently launched the first man into space. And Kennedy's stature had been greatly diminished by the Bay of Pigs invasion, a failed attempt to overthrow the communist government of Cuba. Khrushchev thought the new president was young and inexperienced, perhaps too timid to provide air support for the CIA-backed army pinned down on the beaches of Cuba. Kennedy had hoped that the summit would lead to warmer relations between the two superpowers. Instead, Khrushchev confronted him with an ultimatum. If the United States did not agree to the creation of a free and demilitarized Berlin, the Soviets would sign a treaty with East Germany by the end of the year and severely limit NATO's rights in the city. When Kennedy made clear that would be unacceptable, the Soviet leader didn't back down. "It is up to the United States to decide whether there will be war or peace," Khrushchev said. "Then it will be a cold winter," Kennedy replied. During the Eisenhower administration, the Joint Chiefs of Staff seemed to have few options if the Soviets tried to close the Autobahn to Berlin. A convoy of American troops would most likely depart from West Germany on the road, and if they were attacked, the United States would be under great pressure to launch a massive nuclear strike on the Soviet Union. Secretary of Defense McNamara hoped that a subtler response could be devised. He wanted a plan that would permit the gradual escalation of a conflict and delay the use of nuclear weapons for as long as possible. But the French President Charles de Gaulle and the British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan had little confidence that West Berlin could be defended with conventional weapons. Any suggestion that the United States might not use nuclear weapons immediately, they worried, could weaken deterrence and encourage the Soviets to take risks. General Loris Norstad, the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, agreed with the British and the French. Norstad thought that once the fighting began, the escalation wouldn't be gradual. It would be explosive, and NATO had to be ready for all-out nuclear war. After the Bay of Pigs fiasco, Norstad had persuaded McNamara to keep the Jupiter missiles in Turkey and Italy. "This is the time to create strength," Norstad said, "not reduce it." As Khrushchev continued to make public threats against West Berlin and raise the specter of war, President Kennedy followed the advice of former Secretary of State Dean Acheson. "If a crisis is provoked," Acheson had suggested, "a bold and dangerous course may be the safest. The United States should raise the stakes, send more conventional forces to Germany, and show a willingness to fight." On July 25th, Kennedy gave a televised address on the Berlin crisis. The Soviet Union had no right to restrict NATO's presence in West Berlin, Kennedy asserted, "and we have given our word that an attack upon that city will be an attack upon us all." He proposed a call-up of reservists and National Guard units, an expansion of the draft, the addition of more than 100,000 troops to the army, a delay in the retirement of the Strategic Air Command's B-47 bombers, and a plan to build more civilian bomb shelters in the United States. Angered by the speech, Khrushchev asked John McCloy, a White House advisor who was visiting Russia, to pass along a message. "Tell Kennedy that if he starts a war, then he would probably become the last president of the United States." Although Kennedy and McNamara now understood the urgency of America's command and control problems, little had been done to rectify them. Barely 6 months had passed since the inauguration, and much more time would be needed to make fundamental changes in the system. As the Berlin crisis deepened, the commanders of NATO units were ordered not to use their nuclear weapons without the explicit approval of General Norstad. But locks had not been installed in those weapons, and McNamara soon agreed to equip American troops on the front line with Davy Crockett atomic rifles. They were likely to be the first weapons fired at an invading Red Army. More important, the PSYOP remained the same. It had officially become the nuclear war plan of the United States in mid-April, although Kennedy hadn't even received a formal briefing on it. His national security advisor, McGeorge Bundy, thought that an alternative to the PSYOP was needed now that a war with the Soviets seemed like a real possibility. "The current strategic war plan is dangerously rigid," Bundy informed the president, "and if continued without amendment may leave you with very little choice as to how you face the moment of thermonuclear truth." One of Bundy's aides, Carl Kaysen, was given the task of quickly preparing a new war plan. During the Second World War, Kaysen had selected bomb targets in Germany. He later worked at RAND and served as a professor of economics at Harvard. Kaysen thought that NATO should rely increasingly on conventional weapons, and that Germany should eventually become a nuclear-free zone. Nevertheless, he enlisted help from one of McNamara's aides, Henry Rowan, to come up with a nuclear war plan that the president might actually use. The spasm war, demanded by the current PSYOP, they agreed, was a ridiculous and unworkable notion. Just after midnight, on August 13th, without any warning, East German troops began to string a barbed wire fence between East and West Berlin. For weeks, thousands of people had fled East Germany through the city, the last stretch of the border that hadn't been militarized. NATO troops now watched helplessly as the fence became a wall. After an initial tentative response, on August 18th, President Kennedy ordered a battle group of 1,500 soldiers to travel the Autobahn from West Germany to Berlin. McNamara had opposed the move, afraid that it might start a nuclear war. The Soviets didn't challenge the convoy. When it arrived in West Berlin, the American troops were greeted by hundreds of thousands of cheering Germans and Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, who felt relieved. 12 days later, the Soviet Union surprised the Kennedy administration again, unilaterally ending the moratorium on nuclear tests. As a show of strength, within the next month, the Soviets detonated 26 nuclear weapons. Carl Kaysen's war plan was ready by the first week of September. It was designed for use during the Berlin crisis. "We should be prepared to initiate general war by our own first strike," Kaysen wrote. "We should seek the smallest possible list of targets, focusing on the long-range striking capacity of the Soviets and avoiding as much as possible casualties and damage in Soviet civil society. If President Kennedy launched the current PSYOP, the United States would have to kill more than half of the people in the Soviet Union, and millions more in Eastern Europe and China, just to maintain the freedom of West Berlin. Doing so would be not only morally questionable, but impractical. The scale of the military operations required by the PSYOP was so large, it would inevitably tip off the Soviets that a nuclear strike was coming. It would give them time to retaliate. Kaysen proposed a surprise attack that would use just 41 American bombers approaching at low altitude to destroy roughly twice that number of long-range missile and bomber bases in the Soviet Union. The whole thing would be over no more than 15 minutes after the first bomb dropped. "After the attack," Kaysen suggested, "we should be able to communicate two things to Khrushchev. First, that we intend to concentrate on military targets unless he is foolish enough to hit our cities. Secondly, that we are prepared to withhold the bulk of our force from the offensive, provided that he accepts our terms. Instead of killing hundreds of millions, the raid would probably kill less than 1 million, and probably not much more than 500,000. General Lyman Lemnitzer, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was not overly impressed by the plan. At a meeting the following week, Lemnitzer told President Kennedy that the United States still lacked the command and control capabilities for a limited nuclear attack. Any forces withheld from a first strike might never be available for a second one. And there was no guarantee that Khrushchev would understand, amid the chaos of nuclear war, that only his military targets had been attacked. Kaysen's plan left the Soviet Union's medium-range and intermediate-range missiles untouched. And if Khrushchev didn't get the message and capitulate, Great Britain and most of Europe would be destroyed. Lemnitzer opposed any changes to the PSYOP. "The plan is designed for execution as a whole, and the exclusion of attack of any category or categories of target would, in varying degree, decrease the effectiveness of the plan." General Curtis LeMay wholeheartedly agreed with Lemnitzer. Indeed, if war came, LeMay thought the Soviet Union should be hit by more nuclear weapons, not fewer, to guarantee that every strategic target was eliminated. Despite strong political and philosophical differences, President Kennedy had recently promoted LeMay to Air Force Chief of Staff out of respect for his operational skills. "If you have to go, you want LeMay in the lead bomber," Kennedy later explained. "But you never want LeMay deciding whether or not you have to go." The underlying logic of both nuclear war plans was inescapable. Kill or be killed. General Lemnitzer said that regardless of how the PSYOP was executed, some portion of the Soviet nuclear force would strike the United States. By the fall of 1961, the Soviet Union had about 16 long-range missiles, 150 long-range bombers, and 60 submarine-based missiles that could hit North America. It would be hard to find and destroy every one of them. Kaysen estimated that the number of American deaths stemming from his plan, while small percentage-wise, between 3% and 7% of the total U.S. population, would nevertheless range between 5 million and 13 million. Just a handful of high-yield weapons landing on New York City and Chicago could produce that many deaths. In thermonuclear warfare, Kaysen noted, people are easy to kill. But the alternative to launching a surprise attack on the Soviet Union might be a lot worse. A Soviet first strike could kill as many as 100 million Americans. President Kennedy was wrestling with these issues in the days leading up to his UN speech. The recommendations of the young civilians at the Pentagon seemed, in many ways, to contradict those of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The president would have to decide who was right. Neither superpower wanted a nuclear war, but neither wanted to back down, alienate its allies, or appear weak. Behind the scenes, all sorts of formal and informal contacts were being made between the two governments, including a secret correspondence between Kennedy and Khrushchev. And yet their positions seemed irreconcilable, especially with a deadline approaching. For the Soviet leader, West Berlin was a rotten tooth which must be pulled out, a center of American espionage, a threat to the future of East Germany. For Kennedy, it was an outpost of freedom, surrounded by totalitarian rule, whose 2 million inhabitants couldn't be abandoned. The Berlin Wall, at least, had preserved the status quo. "It's not a very nice solution," Kennedy said the day the barbed wire went up, "but a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war." On September 19th, the day before the White House meeting on whether to launch a surprise attack, Kennedy sent a list of questions to General Power. "Berlin developments may confront us with a situation where we may desire to take the initiative in the escalation of the conflict from the local to the general war level. Could we achieve surprise, i.e., 15 minutes or less warning, under such conditions by examining our current plan? How would you plan an attack that would use a minimum-sized force against Soviet long-range striking power only, and would attempt to achieve tactical surprise? How long would it take to develop such a plan? Is this idea of a first strike against the Soviets' long-range striking power a feasible one? I assume I can stop the strategic attack at any time, should I receive word the enemy has capitulated. Is this correct?" The president also wanted to know if the missiles aimed at Europe could be destroyed by an American first strike. During the meeting on the 20th, General Power expressed concern that Khrushchev was hiding many of his long-range missiles. Without better intelligence, a limited strike on the Soviet Union would be too risky. The choice was all or nothing, and Power advocated an attack with the full PSYOP. "The Western powers have calmly resolved," Kennedy said at the United Nations a few days later, "to defend, by whatever means are forced upon them, their obligations and their access to the free citizens of West Berlin." The following week, Secretary of Defense McNamara told the press that the United States would not hesitate to use nuclear weapons whenever we feel it necessary to protect our vital interests. And he confidently added that America's nuclear stockpile was much larger than that of the Soviet Union. The administration now found it useful to deflate the myth of the missile gap. Details about SAC's ability to destroy the Soviet Union were provided to NATO officials, so that Soviet intelligence officers who'd infiltrated NATO would share the information with the Kremlin. Perceptions of American military strength were important as tensions rose in Europe. Soviet fighter planes buzzed commercial airliners heading to West Berlin and dropped chaff to disrupt their navigational systems. Border guards in East Berlin shot at civilians trying to get past the wall. Police officers in West Berlin responded by firing clouds of tear gas to help the refugees escape, and fought a gun battle with East German police. Although negotiations with the Soviets quietly continued, on October 10th, President Kennedy, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the head of the Joint Chiefs, and a few other advisors met at the White House to finalize plans for a military defense of West Berlin. Everyone agreed about the first three phases, a gradually escalating set of responses with conventional weapons. But a disagreement arose over Phase 4, the point at which nuclear weapons would be introduced. McNamara said that tactical weapons should be used first to protect NATO troops and show the Soviets that America wasn't afraid to fight a nuclear war. But Paul H. Nitze, a McNamara aide and an advocate not only of containing but of overthrowing communist regimes throughout the world, thought the use of tactical weapons would be a mistake. According to notes of the meeting, Nitze said that Phase 4 should begin with the United States launching an all-out first strike against the Soviet Union, because with such a strike, we could in some real sense be victorious. Neither side could be confident of winning a nuclear exchange, McNamara argued, and the consequences would be devastating for both. The meeting ended with the issue unresolved. When President Kennedy later sent instructions for the defense of West Berlin to General Norstad, Phase 4 was made up of three parts. A. Selective nuclear attacks for the primary purpose of demonstrating the will to use nuclear weapons. B. Limited tactical employment of nuclear weapons. C. General nuclear war. Although Norstad was supposed to try A and B before proceeding to C, the behavior of the Soviets could prompt the United States to begin with C. Norstad had already received these orders on October 27th, when Soviet and American tanks confronted one another at Checkpoint Charlie, the last border crossing in Berlin. An American diplomat had been detained by East German border guards the previous week, and a dispute arose over the process of gaining access to East Berlin. American tanks were sent to Checkpoint Charlie as a show of strength. Soviet tanks appeared there at about 5 in the evening on the 27th. The British soon deployed two anti-tank guns to support the Americans, while all the French troops in West Berlin remained safely in their barracks. For the first time since the Cold War began, tanks belonging to the U.S. Army and the Red Army pointed their guns at one another, separated by about 100 yards. General Norstad had ordered his tank commanders to tear down the Berlin Wall if East German guards blocked the rightful passage of American civilians. Amid the armored standoff at the border, Secretary of State Rusk had those orders rescinded. A miscalculation by either side, a needless provocation, could lead to war. The Soviet foreign minister met with the American ambassador in Moscow to discuss the situation. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy, the president's younger brother, had a secret late-night meeting with Georgi Bolshakov, a Soviet intelligence officer in Washington, D.C. The negotiations were successful. 16 hours after arriving at the border, the Soviet tanks turned around and left. The American tanks departed half an hour later. Khrushchev had already backed away from his ultimatum that NATO troops must leave West Berlin by the end of the year, and withdrawing the tanks first seemed like another sign of weakness. 2 days later, Khrushchev made a blunt, defiant statement. Above an island in the Arctic Sea, the Soviet Union detonated Tsar Bomba, the King of Bombs, the most powerful nuclear weapon ever built. It had a yield of 50 megatons. The mushroom cloud rose about 40 miles into the sky, and the fireball could be seen more than 600 miles from ground zero. The shock waves circled the Earth 3 times with enough force to be detected in New Zealand. The Berlin crisis eased somewhat, but Khrushchev did not let go of his central demands. Kennedy distrusted the Soviets, and the city still threatened to become a flashpoint where a Third World War would begin. McGeorge Bundy later recalled, "There was hardly a week in which there were not nagging questions about what would happen if." On November 6th, a tear gas battle erupted between East German and West German police officers. On November 20th, a crowd of 50,000 gathered to protest the wall, and the demonstration ended in chaos, with about 1,000 people battling police. And on November 24th, just before dawn, SAC headquarters in Omaha lost contact with the ballistic missile early warning system radar in Thule, Greenland. A SAC controller picked up the phone and called NORAD headquarters in Colorado Springs to find out what was wrong. The line was dead. The odds of a communications breakdown simultaneously extending east and west from Omaha seemed low. SAC's entire alert force was ordered to prepare for takeoff. At air bases worldwide, klaxons sounded and pilots climbed into hundreds of planes. A few minutes later, the order was rescinded. The B-52 circling Thule had made contact with the base. It had not been destroyed by the Soviets. An investigation subsequently found that the failure of a single AT&T switch in Black Forest, Colorado, had shut down all the ballistic missile early warning circuits, voice communications between the SAC and NORAD command posts, and the hotline linking SAC's commander to NORAD headquarters. AT&T had neglected to provide redundant circuits for some of the nation's most important communications links, despite assurances that it had done so. When news of the Black Forest incident leaked, Radio Moscow claimed the false alarm was proof that any maniac at a U.S. military base can, in a panic, easily throw mankind into the abyss of a nuclear war. The Berlin crisis led Secretary of Defense McNamara to believe even more strongly that NATO's reliance on tactical nuclear weapons increased the threat of a nuclear holocaust. During the first week of May 1962, at a meeting of NATO ministers in Athens, Greece, McNamara urged America's European allies to spend more money on their own defense. Despite having a larger population than the Soviet Union and much larger economies, the European members of NATO refused to pay for conventional forces that could stop the Red Army. In his top-secret speech, McNamara warned that NATO should never be forced to choose between suffering a military defeat or starting a nuclear war. Highly dispersed nuclear weapons in the hands of troops would be difficult to control centrally, he said. Accidents and unauthorized acts could well occur on both sides. In addition to greater spending on conventional weapons, McNamara proposed a new nuclear strategy. Later known as No Cities, it was similar to Kaysen's plan, influenced by Rand, and, like Henry Kissinger's early work, hopeful that a nuclear war could be fought humanely. Its goal was to save the lives of civilians. Our best hope lies in conducting a centrally controlled campaign against all of the enemy's vital nuclear capabilities, McNamara said. Attacking only military targets would give the Soviets a strong incentive to do the same. The centralized control of nuclear weapons was essential for this strategy, and the control would ultimately lie with the President of the United States. McNamara's remarks were partly aimed at the French, who planned to keep their nuclear weapons outside of NATO's command structure. By acting alone during a conflict with the Soviet Union, France could threaten the survival of everyone else. The independent actions of one country, McNamara explained, could lead to the destruction of our hostages, the Soviet cities, just at a time at which our strategy of coercing the Soviets into stopping their aggression was on the verge of success. Without the centralized command and control of nuclear weapons, NATO might suffer the catastrophe which we most urgently wish to avoid. The following month, McNamara repeated many of these themes during a commencement speech at the University of Michigan in his hometown of Ann Arbor. The speech was poorly received. McNamara's plan to save civilian lives, without the classified information that supported its central argument, sounded like a boast that the United States could fight and win a nuclear war. Great Britain and France publicly repudiated the strategy. In their view, the threat of total annihilation was a better deterrent than a more limited and more expensive form of warfare fought with conventional weapons. And America's NATO allies suspected that a no-cities approach would primarily spare the cities of the United States. Nikita Khrushchev didn't like the speech either. "Not targeting cities. How aggressive," Khrushchev told the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet of the Soviet Union. He suggested that McNamara's remarks had a sinister aim, to get the population used to the idea that nuclear war will take place. Although the United States and the Soviet Union publicly supported peace, diplomacy, and a settlement of their differences through negotiation, both countries behaved less nobly in secret. During the summer of 1962, the Kennedy administration was trying to overthrow the government of Cuba and assassinate its leader, Fidel Castro. Robert Kennedy guided the CIA's covert program Operation Mongoose, enlisting help from Cuban exiles and the Cosa Nostra. Robert McNamara supervised the planning for a full-scale invasion of the island should Operation Mongoose succeed. Meanwhile, Khrushchev approved a KGB plan to destabilize and overthrow the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. More important, he decided to turn Cuba into a military outpost of the Soviet Union, armed with nuclear weapons. If Khrushchev's scheme worked, by the end of 1962, the Soviets would have 24 medium-range ballistic missiles, 16 intermediate-range ballistic missiles, 42 bombers, a fighter wing, a couple of tank battalions, anti-aircraft missiles, and about 50,000 personnel in Cuba. The medium-range missiles would be able to strike targets as far north as Washington, D.C., the intermediate range to destroy SAC bases in the West and the Midwest. The Cuban deployment would triple the number of Soviet land-based missiles that could hit the United States. Throughout the summer, Soviet merchant ships secretly transported the weapons to Cuba, hidden below decks, along with troops dressed in civilian clothes. Once the Cuban missile sites were operational, Khrushchev planned to announce their existence during a speech at the United Nations, and then he would offer to remove them if NATO agreed to leave West Berlin. Or he would keep them in Cuba, just 100 miles from Florida, and build a naval base on the island for ballistic missile submarines. "We have no bases in Cuba, and we do not intend to establish any," Khrushchev had assured Kennedy in a personal note. That promise was later repeated by the Soviet ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin, during a meeting with Robert Kennedy. On September 11th, TASS issued a flat-out denial. "Our nuclear weapons are so powerful in their explosive force, and the Soviet Union has such powerful rockets to carry these nuclear warheads, there is no need to search for sites for them beyond the boundaries of the Soviet Union." A month later, photographs taken by an American U-2 spy plane revealed Soviet missile sites under construction in the countryside near San Cristobal, about 50 miles west of Havana. Kennedy had warned the Soviets that the United States would not tolerate the deployment of ballistic missiles in Cuba. Now he had to figure out what to do about them. For the next 13 days, the Kennedy administration debated how to respond, worried that a wrong move could start a nuclear war. Many of the crucial discussions were secretly recorded. The president and his brother were the only ones at the meetings who knew that a tape recorder was running. At first, President Kennedy thought that the Soviet missiles had to be destroyed before they became operational. Most of his advisors felt the same way. They disagreed mainly on the issue of how large the airstrike should be, confined solely to the missiles, or expanded to include Cuban air bases and support facilities. As the days passed, doubts began to intrude. A surprise attack had the best chance of success, but it might anger America's allies in Europe, especially if Khrushchev used it as a pretext to seize West Berlin. A small-scale attack might not destroy every missile and nuclear weapon on the island, but getting them all might require a full-scale invasion. And a blockade of the island would prevent the Soviets from delivering more weapons to Cuba, but it might have little effect on the weapons already there. The Joint Chiefs of Staff unanimously agreed that the Soviet missiles had to be attacked at once, without any warning. Like the Jupiters in Italy and Turkey, the missiles in Cuba weren't protected by concrete silos. From a strictly military point of view, they were useful only for a Soviet first strike, and their strategic purpose seemed to be a decapitation attack against the military and civilian leadership of the United States. The ballistic missile early warning system was oriented to the north and the east, not the south. Missiles launched from Cuba might not be detected until their thermonuclear warheads hit American targets 3 or 4 minutes later. The Joint Chiefs recommended a massive airstrike against the Soviet missiles, planes, and weapons in Cuba. A limited strike would not only be more dangerous, they argued, it might be worse than doing nothing at all. Missiles that survived the attack would probably be hidden or launched, and the one opportunity to destroy them lost. The strategic implications of the missiles meant less to President Kennedy than the intangible threat they posed. It doesn't make any difference if you get blown up by an ICBM flying from the Soviet Union or one that was 90 miles away, he said the day after the missiles were discovered. Failing to destroy them or to force their removal would make America look weak. It might encourage the Soviets to move against Berlin. But attacking the missiles brought a whole new set of risks. At a meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on October 19th, 4 days into the crisis, after the president and his brother and his national security advisors had gone back and forth discussing what sort of action to take, the stark differences between America's civilian and military leadership were exposed. If we attack Cuba, the missiles, or Cuba in any way, then it gives the Soviets a